Welcome, welcome. Here we're gathered for another edition of Overcoming Long COVID and ME/CFS. And today I'm going to have a great time, and I'm sure you will too. We're talking to Oz Garcia. Oz is a true thought leader in the world of optimizing your health. I mean, he's been in this for a long time and has a lot of insights. And unfortunately for him, and fortunately for the rest of us, he wound up with COVID early on and has had to claw his way back from his own experience with long COVID. And so welcome, Oz. I'm really excited to talk to you today. You know, we've been talking to a lot of practitioners and a lot of researchers, and now we're having a chance to talk to somebody who has the research background and has the, let's say, the unfortunate gift of having to have a walk through this.
So, you're right.
So tell me just from the beginning, like what, actually, before you tell me about your story, sure. Tell me a little bit of, and so people will understand about your exploration in how to stay well.
Well, Eric, first of all, thank you for having me on. The exploration has a history to it. I've been at this, what it means to be in the best condition possible, starting in the 1970s. I got very interested in long distance running. I wound up being a marathoner. I did my first marathon in New York in 1979. I was a kid. And that pretty much defined my interest in all the things that could possibly impact my capacity to run well, run better, run fast, recover. So my career, my former career ended in the beginning of the 1980s. I was just completely absorbed with everything that had to do with running. I became a lecturer at the New York Roadrunners Club. I'm sure you're familiar with it. And that kind of started me off on a very different route. The first people that affected my thinking about aging and how to reverse aging were two scientists from MIT, Dirk Pierce and his wife, Sandy Shaw. They wrote the original book on anti-aging. I think it was called Anti-Aging, something like that. And it came out, if I'm not mistaken, in 1981. And that was the trailblazer. And I couldn't put it down. All the information about supplementation and nutrients and amino acids and vitamins and minerals and how they work. So I was fascinated with that. And that took me in a very different trajectory. And I'm here 40 years later talking about it.
Mm. Yeah, no, they were the pioneers, because I was working at that time in what I call regular medicine. And I remember people bringing that into me, and it was eye-opening. And to this day, I have to admit, life extension is a very helpful resource. So
exactly.
And now, so after that, you unfortunately were living in New York at the wrong time. So tell us what happened.
Well, let's just say that I had a certain amount of hubris when the pandemic hit. I thought, given my background, my knowledge, the fact that I have one of the leading consulting firms in well-being, health optimization, nutritional self-care, fitness, and so on, that I would be immune. There was just no way that I could possibly get sick. Now, I went in for elective surgery the end of January 2021, Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, to correct damage that was done to my neck. This is, again, up from years of running. So I had had it all planned out in my head. We're going to start with correcting the cervical bones. We'll bit by bit get the left hip done, the right hip done, the lower back, so on. I was just absolutely delighted. And when I woke up in recovery after having had the plate put in my neck at Mount Sinai, I must have slept, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 hours. And my roommate was somebody who had flown in from England. At that point, Delta Plus was raging in England. This guy was a very well-known rugby player. And we were separated by, as many people know, in a hospital by a curtain. He would periodically come over and ask me how I was doing. And I suspected that this was not proper etiquette at that point, right? The pandemic had kind of slowed down a little bit. People were able to go get elective surgery. And I had requested to be released from the hospital. I figured I need to be someplace safe. I can be alone. This guy's not wearing a mask. And sure enough, when I got home, as the days went on, I'd say beginning of February, I kept feeling awful. And I kept attributing the awful feelings that I had, the exhaustion, increased pains throughout my body, to maybe the surgery didn't work out. Maybe something went wrong. And as often happens, we'll call our doctors and find out if something went wrong with this procedure. Is there anything else I should know? And I was told, no, this is what your recovery is like from this kind of surgery. So I waited it out at home. As the symptoms got worse and worse and worse, I'd say by about day 12, I insisted on going in and having the department, the surgeon that I work with in his department, do x-rays on my neck. Went up there, was masked. They did x-rays on my neck. The doctor spoke to me and I could hardly listen to him as he kept telling me that my neck's fine. And at his suggestion, I was wheeled over. At that point, I must've been kind of keeling over in a wheelchair to the other side of Mount Sinai where they had the COVID ward. Little did I know that COVID was about to take off brutally. And the peak hadn't just begun. The peak in New York was in March, April of 2021. So I was right at the beginning of the peak itself. I asked, once they saw me on at the COVID side of Mount Sinai, could I go home? And they said, no, you need to get up on this gurney. They did a PET scan on my right leg. I had 3 clots in my right leg. Immediately, they took me to the emergency room. And by then I was going in and out of consciousness. When my turn came up, they did a CAT scan on me. My lungs were filled. To quote one of the doctors, I had half my lungs filled with millions of microclots. And that was the beginning of my stay in Mount Sinai for 3 weeks, trying to stay alive. And subsequent to that, when I was released, I'll tell you how I kind of pulled my life together. But it was one of the more brutal times I've ever experienced in my life. I have nothing to compare it to. There were no hospital rooms left, Eric, at that point in Mount Sinai. Actually, when I was in the emergency room, I was seeing people come in gurneys, I'd say in on average about every 5 minutes, more or less. So I knew something was really wrong. Certainly, I knew something was wrong with me. And when I came to, I remember coming to, I came to in a room, not a hospital room, but a converted storage room, which is all that was left in Mount Sinai. And I was sharing it with another gentleman. There were no windows. There was no temperature control. It either got too hot, too cold, too humid. And the poor gentleman that I was sharing the room with was also suffering terribly. And I couldn't make head or tails of what was going on, but I knew something was terribly wrong. I couldn't lift my arms. My breathing was terribly labored. And that was the beginning of a 3-week stay in Mount Sinai COVID ward for all the world to know more or less how bad things were.
Wow. That is incredible. And what's actually fascinating is that you really didn't ever have, it sounds like, much in the way of any upper respiratory tract signs or issues.
Not at all. When I was home, what I wanted to do was just sleep. So my breathing didn't become labored until I was in the hospital. By then, I suppose the amount of fluid that was in my lungs, all viral fluid, all microclots, with one big clot heading for my heart. Who could have ever believed that? And I was a candidate, and we had spoken to this about this briefly before, to go on a mechanical ventilator, but we'll get to that. I'll tell you more or less what they did do with me and how I kind of survived the 3 weeks in the hospital.
Wow. So there you are. This is in 21 now. Yeah, and people forget, I think, sometimes how how, you know, New York got hit so hard in you know, like twice.
Horrifically so. I remember before that, especially during the lockdown and throughout 2021, when 6-7 p.m. would come around, people would go on their balconies and open their windows and bang pots to thank all the EMF workers, the nurses, the medical staff. And this was a routine. It was like an alarm that went off every single day as a reminder of what was going on. So it was a peculiar time, as not only for me, but most people that lived through it, whether in the country, but in the city, that was considered kind of ground zero, again, for the epidemic. It was pretty horrifying.
God. And so, and you got through the hospitalization. I mean, were you able to do anything for yourself during your hospital stay, or were you pretty much?
No. finally, I spent my birthday up there. So as a means of getting products that I knew could make a difference, they were smuggled in birthday boxes, birthday gift boxes. So I had my staff, my brother, bring them up, and the nurses would bring them in. So I was able to take different products that they wouldn't approve in the hospital. So like N-acetylcysteine, NAC, acetylated glutathione, vitamin C, vitamin D, nitric oxide inducers. They smuggled in a powder combination with arginine and citrulline, and I could breathe better after I would use it. But in the hospital, none of that was recognized. I remember one day talking to the head pulmonologist, and I thank God I have my iPhone with me, and I just kept doing searches. That's all I could do with whatever time I had. And I came across an article, I think it was in The Lancet, which is the British version of the American Medical Association's leading book manuals, like, you know, JAMA. And there's an article stating that vitamin D could possibly be helpful in mitigating the effects of COVID. So I remember I showed it to the pulmonologist, and he said to me, well, there's no proof. And I think I lost my voice, which I'd already lost. I wanted to say, well, this is The Lancet that's saying COVID seems to appears to have an effect on mitigating COVID-19. Vitamin D appears to have effects of mitigating COVID-19 effects. He completely dismissed me. I was not on a mechanical ventilator. I was in a high flow oxygen. What do you call them? Calendula or
Cannula.
So they put me on that because I had declined to be put on a mechanical ventilator. And I was told this by the whole pulmonary team that the likelihood is that they would have to make me do it. They contacted my brother. They contacted one of my business partners. And by the way, they were all well-intended. They did save my life. I would have died had I not been in the hospital. But they were equally as overwhelmed. They were equally as lost in the woods as to what to do. So they gave me an antiviral, which was very popular at the time. I took a particular steroid, dexamethasone, which actually allowed me to breathe a lot better. My blood pressure at one point, probably from the fact that the virus had penetrated my heart muscle, my blood pressure went up to about 220 over 120 at one point. So I was on a high blood pressure medication. They put me on antibiotics, beta-blocking. I could just go on. My stomach was just ripped apart. So the experience itself, in terms of trying to save my life, was in many ways kind of looking like this. I could die here. You know, this is the best that's available. And they're not thinking about probiotics. They're not thinking about any other potential nutrients. At one point, they did a search on coffee, and it turns out that coffee is a mild bronchodilator. So I just started drinking coffee. I would beg for coffee. Can I get another cup? Can I get another cup? And that kind of defined most of the time that I was there. Unfortunately, two individuals that I shared rooms with did pass away. They were elderly, and I suspect they were not in all that good a shape. So there's a lot that you walk away from the hospital from in terms of what do I do now? There's a lot of new trauma. There's a lot of PTSD stuff that you've now replugged into your brain and into your body. And nobody has an answer as to what to do with the fact that you can't stop shaking. What are you going to do with your ravaged lungs? I was put in an oxygen compressor. We'll talk about that. What should I eat? Are there any supplements? So my care insofar as what to do to regain my life back ended the day that I went home, 3 weeks after I entered the hospital.
Yeah. No, that is, I mean, the issue of modern medicine is we, about 30 years ago, we made this turn, or 40 years ago, really, where if there wasn't a double-blind placebo-controlled study that was large enough, it's not proven, and it could be dangerous, so we're not going to do it. And I understand if you're going to, if that's a reasonable criteria, if the intervention that you're going to use has a very high likelihood of hurting you. But right. I think it's totally misguided if what you're going to use is generally considered safe. You know, right. I don't think we shouldn't need the same level of evidence, especially in the midst of a pandemic, especially in the midst of a new health crisis. Yes. We should be able to be a little looser, unfortunately not in America, not unless you correct, have, yeah. you know, like $1 billion behind you, like we did with remdesivir. I mean, that was probably one of the things.
Yeah, I was given remdesivir and, like I said, dexamethasone, but nothing else. Anything else that we now recognize may have an effect on speeding up your recovery, certainly have an effect on whether you have post-COVID syndrome, long-haul symptomology, that I had to like fight for myself without much medical input. In other words, if you're looking to medicine to try and solve the problem of being a long hauler, you may miss the point. Now, this is just my opinion. There are plenty of doctors that I admire that I think are brilliant when it comes to the management of long haul COVID. Matt Cook is one. He's out in California, probably not too far from you, who's got some remarkable ways of thinking about post-COVID and long-haul COVID. Andrew Levinson in Florida is a brilliant psychiatrist, has a clinic in Miami and South Beach where he uses hyperbaric tanks, other approaches, and so on. So I kind of started to, once I got home and I looked in the mirror, I went from weighing 140 to 98 pounds. So I was unrecognizable. I could not recognize what I saw in the mirror. And I remember weeping, just absolutely weeping. One, that I was home and I had my bed, but weeping at the person that I didn't recognize in the mirror. I could count my bones. My gums were bleeding. I think I mentioned to you before, I'd lost a couple of teeth. I was actually able to pull them out when I got home. Just as my body was just decimated, I had no strength. And I was hooked up to an oxygen compressor at home where I was breathing 6 liters of oxygen 24 hours a day, down from 65, by the way, when I was in the hospital. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I needed to figure out, based on my history, everything that I knew, Can I solve this catastrophe? Can I get back to where I was before I had COVID? Is that a possibility? When nobody knew anything, there was just no way to address it, because no matter what I did, whatever searches you were doing at that time, nothing satisfactory came up online.
Yeah, no, we were blind. I mean, except just going back to, okay, your body's just been through an incredible inflammatory experience. And is there still ongoing inflammation? And as you said, you know, looking at the clotting issues, you're really left to your own devices. And
that's
so,
correct.
But luckily, you had a lot of devices to try. So let's go through some of them. What did you start to do to help bring yourself back?
Well, I knew that where I needed to begin was my breathing. So I couldn't get to the bathroom from my bed, from the bedroom, my bed to the bathroom without being winded. Right. And I would have to crawl part of the way. And I figured maybe that's where I need to start. So they gave me in the hospital a spirometer. I know what you know what a spirometer is, right?
Yeah, just something, but basically for the just something where you get to blow into a device and it can kind of measure how much air you're moving, but more importantly, it exercises your lungs, and that's why they give it to you when you go home.
Correct. So I took one home and I kept playing with it, and I thought to myself, I don't think this is going to ever get me back to where I was before, right? So I began to investigate breathing approaches, yogic breathing. I spoke to a number of friends of mine. One is a very well-known athlete who turned me on to a breathing device. It's funny. I have it here by coincidence. It's called, by the way, none of this is anything that I endorse or I'm being paid for. This saved my life. This is called, let me see if we can see it, an AeroFit. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, an AeroFit, you can get on Amazon. You put it in your mouth, has an app, and it can mimic anything from walking through a meadow, breathing, to running up a steep incline, to being 11,000 feet above sea level, right? And I figured, all right, let me try this thing. And this is the beginning of how I built back my breathing capacity. So I use it every day. I rarely miss it. I started at beginner. 1 minute, that was about all I could do without collapsing and exhaustion, to where now I can do 20 minutes at advanced on some of the toughest dial-ins that you can do on it. So now I can run up 4, 5, 6 flights of stairs, whereas I could hardly, like I said to you before, even walk parallel to try and get from one room to the other without being fully exhausted. So that was the beginning. It's like, can I get control over my breath? Then it was, after everything that I've been through, is there a possibility that my immune system is still compromised? What about the possibility, we don't know yet, that there are viral particles left behind in my brain and so on? My thinking wasn't all that sharp. So I could walk into another room and wonder what I was doing there. Just what am I doing here? Walk back, still not remembering, go, oh, okay. And then go back, and sometimes it would take me 2 or 3 attempts to actually remember why I had walked into the other room in my apartment. So it was, okay, so what do I need to do to repair the damage to my brain? Because there's a lot of talk going on among the doctors and the articles that I'm reading that there's damage that can occur to the brain. The protein extensions from the virus itself do move the virus into the brain. And even after you lose most of the virus, after most of it is cleared from your body, a lot isn't. There's much speculation even today that some viral particles remain in the body. Maybe some of the virus itself remains in the body, and it may account for a lot of the problems that plague post-COVID sufferers, certainly long haulers. So I put together a whole protocol of different nutrients that actually could have an impact on my thinking. So that was part two.
Right. And because we have to remember is that, you know, the thinking, you know, your brain depends on circulation.
Correct.
And also inflammatory chemicals that still can be, like, while your body's repairing, there's often a lot of inflammatory chemicals that are being released. So whether, you know, and the spike protein itself is so pro-inflammatory, you know, so all these things, so anything that will lower your inflammation will hopefully help your brain.
No question about it. Well, at the beginning, I was so thin, and I'd been for a long time pretty much a pescatarian, kind of leaning very close to classical Greek dietary guidelines, meat once in a while, a lot of intermittent fasting, but now I'm down 40 pounds. So what do? How do you gain back your muscle mass? Yes, it would have been great to if I could have gained it back. Being on a more plant-based diet, I would have done it, but that was out of the question. And I was really scared that I was going to fracture something because I was just so thin. So my diet, so that was the next thing. All right, what do you eat? So it's going to be a combination of paleo, keto, ancestral dietary practices with a lot of plant-based food in there, a lot of fruit, most of it cooked. In fact, all my plant and fruit consumption was mildly steamed, poached, so that I could digest it a lot better. And an enormous amount of fat, plant-based fat, nut butters, cashew nut butter, almond butter, hazelnut butter, a lot of meat. I was consuming an enormous amount of seafood, high quality organic beef, same thing with lamb. I needed to do anything that I could. I remember listening to, watching a movie back, it must've been back in the 80s with Arnold Schwarzenegger. It was his breakthrough film. Can't remember the name right now, but he talked in that film. He was at the peak of his stunningness, how he had put on all the muscle he did by eating as much meat as he could. And I remembered that, and I remember that I thought, oh, okay, let me speak to some of my friends that are experts in paleo or keto. And I constructed a way of eating to get my muscle mass back, and it worked.
Wow. Yeah. And that is a good, lets us know that the inflammation in your system was getting under control. Because if you can build muscle, you know, you there's, because when you have too much inflammation, you're not gonna your mitochondria aren't gonna process the fats.
That's,
you know,
correct.
And the protein. So it's really good. So we see that you were, I think one of the things that we see over and over again is people who start basically healthy have a much, much better chance of recovering. And, you know, one of the things that we've seen is that even the people who are on a lot of good supplementation just have done a lot better.
Yeah. Remember why I got hit was because I had a 2.5-hour surgery on my neck, right? So my immune system was depressed from that. The anesthesia, as you and I know, can knock your immune system out too. And being in a room with somebody who was like my ground zero, my main exposure under those circumstances, who would have thought that you could pick this stuff up in a hospital?
Yeah. Well.
Remember, you pick up a lot of stuff in the hospital.
Unfortunately, hospitals are a den, not of iniquity, but a den of bugs. That's where the worst bugs live, unfortunately. Yes. But I think that's what speaks, well, is that you were in a, the immune system can only do so much at a time, and your immune system was basically focused on healing.
That's
and
correct.
So getting that infection at the same time, your body just wasn't ready for it.
No, and it was a double slam. It was like getting slammed to the nth degree with the worst possible case of COVID, severe COVID pneumonia, consuming my body while I'm recovering from neck surgery, right? And it was an unimaginable state to be in. While in the hospital, being home, wondering, trying to make sense of all of this. It was not anything that you could put together and try and explain to yourself, explain to other people. So I think a lot of long haulers need to deal with their thinking, how it is that they can then put together their character so that they can then surmount the suffering. And so that was the next project. Right? How do I now get my thinking in line so that I'm not crying over spilt beer, singing the blues? Why me? How could this happen? It happened. It happened to you. And this is what I had said about a certain degree of hubris, that I thought it would never touch me. And here I am it with the worst possible outcome in terms of COVID. I had friends, I had acquaintances that had gotten COVID, and they stayed home, drank some miso soup and quarantine, and they were back to skiing in 2 weeks. I'm like, I am completely screwed. I don't see an end to this. But as I got control over my thinking, more through mindfulness practices. So I want to be careful how I say this. I was a meditator before, but I didn't take it as serious as I did afterwards. So now it's every day. A certain amount of time is dedicated to mindfulness meditation practices. And there was a device, because I could hardly control the voice in my head. It was just spinning. What does this mean? What's going to happen? Are things going to get worse? And if you started Googling everything about long haul COVID and you know, kidney failure, pancreatic inflammatory disease, it was like, oh my God, what? I'm not going to make it 5 years. And to quiet that, so I began to practice mindfulness every single day. And I did use a device for that too. The device that I love that helped me immensely was Muse. Right. So Muse comes in different forms. I think the Muse S is the one that I got and I use regularly. And it allows you to regulate your thinking. It calms the voice in your head, the neural default network, where the voice tends to go by the exercises, kind of like a neurofeedback device. So that as it calms you down, you're working, you're earning your way through by using Muse. New Calm, which I love. New Calm is another application to get control over stress, anxiety, a wandering mind, the neural default network. So between New Calm, Muse, I would spend a certain amount of my day just training my thinking, getting control over my thinking all over again.
Yeah, and this is crucial because people always forget that the brain does control the immune system.
Correct.
And when you're weak and inflamed, the cells in your brain that normally will calm those, that noise will keep those incessant thoughts from, you know, really being a big part of your life.
Yes.
Those win because they should be damped down. But when there's inflammation and not enough blood flow, they have a field day. So you have to do that work. And that's something I think that's so good to hear, how you were able to, you know, to make use of your brain to regain control of your whole body.
Thank you, Eric. Yes. And I would say that this had to happen. I got to reflect back on how my thinking was prior to having been sick. And the fact that I'd been the kind of runner that I was, the training that I had undergone for 35, 40 years to become the kind of runner that I was, served me well in terms of my recovery. So in the absence of wanting to do anything, get up, meditate, prepare my food, use my supplements, bother to educate myself about my options, getting all the things put together and making the effort to actually rise above my condition, I have to credit the years of training to actually kind of pull it out of nowhere, because I didn't feel like doing anything. There were times where I just wanted to stay in bed, not get out. And there were times where my thoughts went to really the dark side. Like, if this is the rest of my life, what's the point? And to be able to get a grip over that and dismiss it, let it know that it's going to pass, and get on with your affairs, pull out your spreadsheet. What's the next thing you got to do? What's the next thing? So I would say that grit is critical to recovery. I think discipline and understanding at that point that it's discipline all the way out. This is what you said you were going to do. You're going to walk 20 feet from your bed to the living room. You're not going to crawl. And you're going to lower the oxygen compressor from 6 liters to 3. Can you do it? I was very influenced by James Clear and his book, Atomic Habits. James is probably one of the world's leading thinkers on developing new habits and practices. He's all over YouTube. Atomic Habits is a remarkable book. And his story was very inspiring. I listened to it on audiobooks in the hospital. And certainly at home, I would review it. But his premise in large measure is the way that you change is you do one little tiny atomic thing every day. And you improve by a percentage point every day. I really took that to heart. If it was like today, I can take 20 steps Can I do 20 and a half tomorrow? Can I do 21 the following day? Can I do 21 and a half? And finally, until I could just completely walk without the oxygen compressor, right? And then sleep without it, right? And then not take a nap in the afternoon, which is months into the recovery. But James Clear's approach in don't think you're going to make a big leap all at once. It's just not going to, right? It's do one little thing. Can you do this other thing today? Can you turn up the aero fit from beginner to intermediate and do 3 minutes? So it was earning back. And I really admire that person that I embodied at that time for the resilience I exhibited when I should have died.
No, you know, once the blood clots start happening, it's and you start losing oxygen and lung capacity, it's a hard, you know, I mean, that's where the fatality, the mortality rate went way up.
Oh yeah. Well, my right now you and I are at sea level, unless you're not, but I suspect you are.
No, I am right here.
So we're breathing 21% oxygen, right? And at least that's the oxygen saturation in the air that you and I are breathing. And then there's the oxygen saturation that's in our body. So it should be at plus 95%, 96, 98. If you and I go for a long walk and we're talking and we're running, we'll hit 100%, 100% oxygen saturation. So my typical oxygen saturation was typically at about 98%, 98, 99, and go work out, you hit Equinox, whatever you do, your oxygen saturation is going to go up. When they took my oxygen in the hospital, the first day that I was there, I was, if I'm not mistaken, I had hit 76%. In other words, I was dying. My brain was dying.
Yes. No. Those. I mean, that's what COVID. You know, COVID seems to have moderated a bit, but when you got hit with it, that's what was happening. People, you know, they would be like, you know, 94, 93, and then they would precipitously drop.
Correct.
Into, once you got below the 80s, it got really iffy. How well you were
terrible,
going to do.
Absolutely terrible. And I had no idea. And thank God that I didn't have to go on a mechanical ventilator. That just said, so everybody knows, a mechanical ventilator is the breathing is so bad and the likelihood of you surviving is really poor. You will be sedated and a tube is put down through your throat into your lungs and oxygen is pumped in mechanically through this device, a mechanical ventilator. It will do the breathing for you. Now you can be on that device for hours, days, weeks, months. I couldn't imagine. I already knew the statistics going into the hospital that if you went on a mechanical ventilator, your chances of coming out alive were less than 2 out of 10. So that's that. Somehow I had the capacity to fight to not go on it. they had the machine in the room. Well, but here we are.
No, but it's, you know, the problems of the machine are just that it's traumatic to the lung and
right.
There's lots of downsides. I mean, that was one of the things that some of the early smart doctors noticed, that people were better off without it. You know, for most lung diseases, the ventilator is life-saving, but yeah. In this particular case, it actually, the trauma was not usually worth it. So,
correct.
But you've crawled yourself back, and now more than crawled, you run back at this point.
Correct.
You're back with us. So, obviously the basic supplements, but the big thing here that I'm hearing was the being able to harness your will, being able to get alignment with your will and your spirit to do what needed to be done, you know, that is the most difficult thing, because when you're, you know, it's one thing to harness your will when you're strong and good and you're feeling great. It's a much, much, much harder thing to do when you're in bed and can't move. So
well,
I mean, that's
it gives you great respect, Eric, for people around the world that are suffering terribly in conditions that to you and me and many people that will be listening to this broadcast don't have any experience of what that's like. You know, if you're a refugee escaping from Syria, if you're being bombarded in Ukraine, if you're in Somalia now, where we've got a famine that's going to, you know, top millions of people. The estimate is that maybe five to seven million people may die. I can't, you know, having gone through what I went through gave me an insight to the condition, the suffering that we do go through in this life, not the needless suffering, that there's plenty of that, but the real actual suffering that we endure. So my value system shifted immensely. I went from being a celebrity nutritionist and the kind of rock star clients that I had and flying the globe and thinking that I was, you know, the SHIT and to all of a sudden realize that I'm in there with humanity, with no exception, that I almost died. And as a matter of fact, recognizing that, like everything in this planet, there's an exit point, there's a finitude to my life. And to recognize that, to know that I'm not immortal. And many of us have carried that over from our youth. You know, it's just gonna go on and go on and on. Well, it's not. And being surrounded with people that were dying and then seeing myself almost go down that tube gave me a lot more interest in, like, okay, you're gonna do everything possible to make it through this. And then you're gonna figure out how do you get back to optimizing your health so you make it as long as possible. So that brought me to the next thing, which was the microbiome. And all the things that you and I understand are critical about the health of our bowel and the role of the microbiome along with the brain in terms of determining our immune condition, how well the immune system will perform. Now, I knew that my microbiome had been wiped out. The microbiome is the environment made up of a multitude of bacteria that live inside of us, habitate within our bowel. One that's very common that most people know about is Acidophilus, right? So Acidophilus, Lactobacillus acidophilus, is in many fermented foods, yogurts, cheeses, beverages, kombucha, and so on. But there are many, 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 many kinds of probiotics. We now know that there are probiotics that direct how immune cells within the body will behave, white blood cells, macrophages, lymphocytes, and so on, and will determine in large measure how the brain will behave. So we both know that there's an intimate connection between the bowel and the brain itself, the gut-brain connection. So at that point, I began to introduce a multitude of fermented foods and probiotics into my daily routine. Those are the first supplements that I began to use. And every single day, handfuls of some of the most exotic probiotics you can imagine. I had a friend that fermented something for me. It was a combination of mango and papaya and apricots and pears, and just let it bubble over. And I would take a scoop of that every day and put it into a smoothie. And that was critical in normalizing my bowels too. My bowels were on fire. Coming out of the hospital where they feed you hospital food, you can't even imagine. Breakfast was plastic eggs and bacon. I'm going after the hospital food. This is horrific. Cream, and I'm lactose intolerant. Sugar to put in your coffee. That was the one thing that I would have. I would have the coffee and pick up the food. Lunch was GMO chicken, mashed potatoes, and corn. Dinner was the same thing. This is the same thing every day. And I finally got a hold of somebody who was able to bring up a piece of salmon, brown rice and vegetables, and it was a hospital version of this, but it was like real food. I get to have one real meal. So I'm very conscious of the fact these days of what it is that I do eat, given that and I'm not a goody-goody, but in order to maintain the stability that I do enjoy, the way that I eat is just very, very well thought out. So what it is that I have in the mornings and the afternoons and the evenings is critical to controlling my fatigue, any lingering problems that I may suffer that are left over from when I had COVID. So diet is critical, as is a wide assortment of probiotics in terms of how do you build yourself back?
Yeah, no, this is so important. In fact, we do have an interview with Dr. Hazan, who's a gastroenterologist and a real deep interest in just how the bacteria in our gut actually help balance the viral loads that we have.
Correct.
There's so much that has to do with the gut and you know, you've got it. The gut and the brain, they talk to each other, and the gut is often is the first step in the conversation. So it's crucial.
Correct. And there, what you want to do is create the environment in the bowel where the probiotics can actually thrive and do what they're supposed to. So there's a category of nutrients called prebiotics. We have probiotics, and then you have postbiotics. So that's conversation for another time, but you want to make sure that you have all three. And prebiotics, the one that I love and I would recommend here is just Jerusalem artichoke powder. One of the best prebiotics in the world. It sets the stage for the bacteria that you do consume to stick and adhere to the wall of the bowel better, as best as possible. And then there are postbiotics. These are nutrients that feed the bacteria so that they actually thrive in the bowel wall. So it's pre, pro, and post. Postbiotic supplements that I like are butyric acid, butyrate. I think butyrate is remarkable. As the name implies, its original source, when it used to be source, it would be from butter. Butter, high quality butter is very high in butyric acid. And that makes for a really healthy bowel environment too. So it's the pre, the probiotics that you take, and then the postbiotics. So I take butyric acid in a form called tributyrate, and it has a remarkable effect on lowering inflammation systemically and within the bowel wall.
Yeah. No, what you are laying out is just so crucial, because, you know, basically I consider the bowel, when people have, once you're in trouble with it, it's a question of urban renewal, you know.
Correct.
You have to get the neighborhood healthy and safe again.
Correct.
You know, and you know, if you just put in the good stuff, but the neighborhood is unsafe, they're going to all be swallowed up and killed. And, you know, because we see that. We see people who've been taking probiotics for years, but it doesn't change the bowel milieu.
That's correct.
And that's what's so important. And I like the way you laid that out with the pre and post support.
Thank you.
Because you need the right environment, and creating that is crucial. So
exactly.
And so you wrote a book after COVID, and so I'm in that book you've outlined some of these your steps forward.
Pretty much so. The book is in two parts, Eric. The first part of after COVID, and I'll hold up the cover again, is pretty much the story, my story of being in the hospital. Part two is a workbook, so it has all the supplements that I use, all the nutrients that I use, the different protocols. I got very interested in extremes of heat and cold. So I would do infrared saunas, then do an ice cold water dip, or I would fill up my tub with ice water. I would do cryotherapy. This is the Wim Hof approach to getting kind of shocking your body to better health. So shocking it in the right way is called hormesis. This is the kind of stress which is good for your body, and it will do wonders. Exercise is hormetic in terms of what it does. It's a certain kind of stress for your body that's good for it. Intermittent fasting, underfeeding is good for your body. Produces a certain kind of stress, and your body's going to swipe up a lot of dead zombie cells, senescent cells, and so on. And I wanted to make sure that I hit all the things in the workbook part that matter. Cleaning up my sleep, which is a disaster. Are you wearing an Oura ring, by the way?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, me too. Here we go. All right. So,
yeah, it's made me more honest.
It does. Really changes you. It's the first thing I look at when I wake up. It's like, put on my phone, look at the app. How was my sleep? It's like 94 HRV, you know, 40. It's like, yes. You know, ordering is terrific. So I talk about the different devices, everything from what I showed here before, the Oura Ring, all the different tools, the biohacking, neurohacking tools to get me to where I wanted to get sooner. And I knew that I needed to improve my sleep too. So there's a whole section in the book on the different nutrients and supplements that I use still now to put me into deep sleep and keep me asleep and wake up feeling refreshed. And the supplements to build power, to build better brain performance, to get your muscle mass back up again, to deal with your psychological states. How do you indeed deal with your DNA, which may be also damaged terribly? So all that's laid out in the workbook part of after COVID.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful because it like you said, it's a journey of many, many steps and different paths for different people. So it's That's really correct. Nice, you know, and to people have a chance to like pick and choose what resonates with them and what they're able to do. I think that's one of the important things is that, you know, one of my frustrations sometimes with the biohacking field is that it's often made up of people who are mostly made up of people who are athletes. And what the world forgets is that athletes are different than a lot of us other mere mortals.
You Correct.
Know, there are those people who like, let's go for a run. And then there are people like me. My favorite line is, you know, okay, when's lunch? but yet we have to, in order to keep having lunch for many years in a healthy state, we have to emulate and do some of the work that the people who are athletic and naturally push themselves do. You know,
That's
for
correct.
Some of us, a little harder to do it, but it's important. The modern world has made it for the first time that many of us get to live a life of excessive leisure. Maybe not leisure, but excessive sitting. And so we really need to learn and take up the lessons that the athletes have learned and that we know, as you spoke of hormesis, the idea that, you know, basically when you push yourself, you let your body heal. The yes. body has to, you have to stress the system to get the body to kill off the weakened cells.
Yes.
Otherwise,
yes.
they stay around far
That's
too
correct.
Long.
Very much so. And you know, we're a very hedonistic culture. And when you're dealing with what we've dealt with for the past 3 years, you got to get off the hedonic treadmill. And get active. You got to get active. You got to get educated. You got to use your curiosity, which is what I did to save my ass. You can't just lay back and think that it's all going to wind up fine. If left to its own devices, you and I both know things go into deep entropic endings. You know, you got to participate in your health and well-being. You gotta read, a lot. You gotta get outdoors. You gotta, even in the winter, walk out to the street, look up, even on a cloudy day. Andrew Huberman would tell us this, right, from Stanford,
yep.
that exposing your eyes to greenery will make a big difference in terms of how your day goes. And so as cornball as some of these things sound, it's important. It was important in my recovery. And I suspect it would be many people that do watch this broadcast, whether they've got chronic fatigue, whether they're dealing with long haul, whether it's some stuff that's lingering from post-COVID. There's an exploratory porthole you got to get through. And I think the book itself after COVID gives you one door to go through with a lot of options on the other end.
And that's, I thank you for that, because I think, you know, you can spend a lot of money going to a lot of doctors, but self-care is your first and best step.
Yes.
It really is important. So thank you so much for your time. I mean, this was great. And I'm so glad that you made it through this. I mean,
you are a
very lucky man.
Thank you. Very.
And I really thank you for, sharing your experience. And especially like, because there I said you before, you're someone who has done the deep work for many years on what actually works for people. And so again, thank you. Because otherwise it can be very difficult to decide which way to go. So thank you again. Pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. And remember, if anybody wants to reach us, they can get us on our website. It's ozgarcia.com, simple. And the latest book is After COVID. It's on Amazon. Thanks, Eric. I'm beyond happy that we had this time.
My pleasure.